Okay. Hi, everybody. Well, my name is Victor Silva Aguirre. I'm a kind of a PhD student at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics. And today I want to tell you a bit about the work that we've been doing with Kepler in, well, sorry, going back to 1D, in evolutionary tracks and, well, convective cores and detailed models. I should mention that I'm just speaking on behalf of a large collaboration with a lot of people that participate, and we wouldn't be in the place where we are without them, and probably I'm forgetting somebody, and I'm really sorry about that if it's the case. So, as an introduction, so stellar modeling in 1D, where are we? So I think from this conference and previous one, it's been clear that the seismology is being driven by the observations. They're flooding us with data. We really don't have any idea what to do with them. We cannot reproduce them. We cannot match them. It's crazy. So we really need to learn about the changes that are happening in stellar interiors with evolution. And in particular, mixing processes such as convection that Steve Gavaler mentioned extensively in his talk on Monday. And why mixing processes such as convection? Well, because one of the important outputs that people want from this community is ages, as Lars mentioned yesterday as well. And that is, I think Gunther said that as well, that the ages are I mean, it's very important that we get the stellar interior right in order to get ages properly, especially in the case of convective cores. So one idea that we had to start doing this is doing some kind of differential analysis. So can we identify sequences of star along and build evolutionary tracks and try to get ages differentially and see if we can tell something about the interiors? So, well, Travis and Tim, they both already introduced the famous mixing, scaling relations, which are those two that I have there. So basically, if you measure the global oscillation parameters, nu max and delta nu, and you have an estimate of the effective temperature, you can directly obtain the mass and radius of the star. The important thing is this is the direct method is model independent, so no need to do modeling in there. So we did that. We took a data set of Kepler observations, more than 500 main sequence stars. We're going to stay in the main sequence for now. We measure the global this nu max and delta nu, extract by different pipelines, estimated the effective temperatures using the infrared flux method that Luca Casagrande spoke about. He did the temperature calculations. And as a first approach, we try to find is a solar evolutionary sequence. So a sequence of star which have roughly one solar mass. Okay, so that's the data. Again, plot is in terms of nu max, inverse, which is a proxy for luminosity, and in terms of effective temperature. I have put there four evolutionary tracks, 0.85, 1, and 1.15. Those are solar metallicity. And I put one at one solar mass at minus 0.5. So you have an idea of the spread that you get according to mass and the spread that you get according to metallicity. So you see that you have a large amount of candidates which basically follow the position where the tracks are, so that's well, that's very encouraging. So after, I mean, for all this, we determine mass and radius, and which are candidates that had a mass, according to this direct method, as we call, of one solar mass plus minus 0.15, which are all the red that I have marked here. And that, I mean, that looks great. The stellar tracks based compass, the position of the star, we have no idea about the metallicity of this of these targets. That's one of the problems that I think has been mentioned already for the Kepler field. We have photometry, but we don't have a lot of spectroscopy. So, okay, this looks very nice, but it's true. But what we're really measuring here, I mean, are these really stars of between 1 and 1.15 or 0.85 solar masses, or a mixture between metallicity and masses that we're not really able to disentangle, right? Luckily, four of these guys, that these are marked here in blue squares, we had spectroscopic metallicity, so at least we could start putting some anchor points using this, okay? By the way, individual frequencies for all of them yet. But for these four guys, we can compare, using the metallicity estimates, how much we deviate from, first, a one solar mass track, a solar metallicity, so the zero point is basically if it will overlap with the one solar mass at solar metallicity track, which they don't, so there's a shift effective temperature, okay? But we have metallicity measured for all of these stars. So now we compare how much they offset with the one solar mass track at the metallicity of each one of these four stars. Okay? These two already agree, and that's encouraging because according to the direct method, their masses agree with one solar mass within one sigma. The other two are slightly more massive. And then besides using the, say, right metallicity from spectroscopy, we also include the right mass that we get from the direct method. And all of them agree, at least in the position of the star track within one sigma. So at least it's encouraging, and on top of that, we get very good agreement of the log G that we determine using our masses and radius with the log G that we get from spectroscopy. So good start. So, where does that leave us? So, apparently, we can successfully identify a sequence of main sequence stars. And that's very exciting because differentially, we could study the internal structure and the changes throughout the evolution. However, we don't, well, the individual frequencies of some of these stars should come very soon, if I'm not mistaken, in a couple of weeks from PE15. But anyway, we still have uncertainties in the scaling relations and the metallicity. Okay, apparently the scaling relation for delta nu for the Lac Fugue separation has been tested, but nu max is a completely definition. We're not very sure about that. And so we did this for a one solar mass and we found a tract, but can we do the same thing for slightly more massive stars and try to see if we find something about the convective core? Can we say something about if the convective core exists or not? Or at least if we can provide some anchor points in a bit more above stars. So about convective cores, why do we care about them? I think that's the first point. So as been said already, the different types of mixing processes, such as overshooting, diffusion, rotational mixing, have of course strong impact in the evolution of stars. And they also have some impact in the observable quantities, luminosity, effective temperature, and surface abundances. And this of course impacts the age and mass determinations that we can do from, say, classical observations, such as isochrome feeding. In particular, I want to remind you that the overshooting is usually calibrated using this little hook in global clusters. So you match an isochrome, you try to reproduce this hook, which is a product of the convective core retreating. So the only way you can produce that is if you had a convective core during the main sequence. And this is the case of M67. It has also been used to try to find constraint in the solar abundances. But that's basically the best that can be done without seismology. And also the convective cores are important to understand more advanced evolutionary stages. So the difference between stars that at the tip of the red giant branch go through the helium flash or not will depend on the size of the helium core and therefore in the size of the amount of overshooting that you have during the main sequence, if you have at all. So we really need to know what's going on in the deep interior of the star, okay? So what determines the size and existence of a mix region? So first you have to use, in 1D at least, a convective boundary definition criteria, okay? Which we have heard already, what we use normally is Ledoux and the Schwarzschild criteria. Ledoux takes into account the variations in the molecular weight. Schwarzschild doesn't take them into account. And that defines your boundary, but once you have your convective zone, you have to decide if you're gonna mix beyond it or not. And that's usually done, for instance, as overshooting or semi-convection that we have heard. And how can we test this with seismology? Well, we have to find frequency combinations which are sensitive to the deep interior where we were aiming to find the convective cores. And they have been proposed by Roxburgh and Bonansov in 2003 to use the frequency ratio. So these are combinations first of eight frequencies of five frequencies each divided by the Lac Fugue separation. And they are centered in L equals zeros and one mode. So we can basically plot them as one full set centering in different frequencies. So what we did is we did first a theoretical study about the impact of these different convective criteria definition in the main sequence. So we produce models using the Ledoux criteria in blue, the Schwarzschild criteria in red, and including overshooting in green throughout the main sequence. And we pick up models, I'm not tall enough, that have the same like frequency separation, okay? The position in the HR diagram is basically the same, so the different size of the convective core doesn't tell you much you cannot disentangle that from the say normal observations, but you will see, this is a plot of the sound speed as a function of acoustic radius, where you have the discontinuities where you have the position of the convective core, which are of course very different, but yeah, you won't be able to determine from normal observations. But if you plot the frequency ratios, you will see that this guy, which is the Ledoux, that doesn't really grow in time because the molecular weight barrier doesn't allow him, his ratios basically stay the same with a constant slope throughout the evolution, while the other ones who are growing are moving towards larger slopes and larger absolute slope and lower mean values, okay? So basically what we thought is that we could try to constrain the size of the convective core using this part, say, linear range of the frequency ratios, which should be sensitive to the very deep interior of the star. So what we found in this study is that the slope of the frequencies in this, say, linear range was sensitive to three things. First, the central hydrogen content, regardless if there's a convective core. You don't have a convective core, you still burn material, and you produce a say, gradient of the sound speed. So you're going to be sensitive to that. You're going to be sensitive to the size of the sound speed discontinuity, because you find a jump when you have a convective core. That's probably not happening in start, but that's in 1D models, that's basically what we do. And third, you're going to be sensitive to the extension of the core. Okay, so those are the three things that we're trying to measure. And we are characterizing this ratio using the mean value and the slope, which was already proposed in 2005. Okay, so the idea is we take this radius, we measure the absolute slope and the mean value, and with that we try to characterize the interior of the star. And with that, we can basically build a sequence. So we can plot this as a slope versus mean diagram. And since the star evolves, the slope and the mean value change, and we can actually have a, say, evolutionary sequence for these stars in terms of mean and the slope. And of course, if you this is for a 1.1 solar mass star, and these two dots, they have exactly the same large frequency separation. But this guy has a convective core, and this one doesn't. So in principle, this could tell us about the existence of a convective core for stars where we know the mass roughly okay. But there are a couple of caveats, of course. First of all, we assume in this study that the masses were known with a precision better than 10%. That's what the direct method kicks in. And second, we did this for solar metallicity. So we don't know exactly how this impacts on the other, on the ratios. But anyway, we can go to Kepler targets, and I mean, I think this is a beautiful example of 9 months of Kepler data. I have to say that we don't know the metallicity for this target, okay? We have two spectroscopic determinations, and they don't agree within one sigma in effective temperature, log G, and metallicity. So we're a bit lost. But anyway, the frequency spectrum is actually very, very nice. So we did detailed modeling of these stars using everything, the methods that you have heard of, automatic, using genetic algorithm, Levenberg, Marquardt, et cetera, different oscillation codes, different evolutionary codes, and most of them including the DEM surface correction that we heard a lot about. So here I'm going to show two of them. Somebody asked how an Echelle diagram looked for a non-corrected. So the blue one is a model that didn't use the surface correction to find the best one, and the red one did use it. So of course it looks much better, but what do we do with the surface correction term? That's what we've been wondering a lot. I want to go back to the sun a bit in that sense. So this is the solar model from Serenelli et al. 2009, probably the most updated one. So here you see solar data in black, and the frequencies from the solar model, uncorrected and corrected in blue and in red. And well, the mismatch is obvious, but what if we go to the frequency ratios? So you probably don't see the blue model is because it overlaps exactly with the red one. So we know that the frequency ratios are very, very sensitive to this wrong modeling that we know we're doing of the outer layers. So in the sun, and this has been known, I mean, I'm not saying anything new, this has been known since 2003 at least. Now, for the target that I have, basically this is the frequency range that I see around the value of nu max, the amount of radial orders that I have. So I can try to characterize using that frequency range using the slope and the mean value of the ratios. Okay. So again, in this mean and slope diagram that I presented before, that's the one sigma error for the solar values. Okay. And the solar model falls exactly in the middle. Doesn't matter if the frequencies are corrected or uncorrected. The mean value and the slope of the ratios is exactly the same, and it fits the data. So at least the internal part, we're doing okay. Now, that's where our star is. Of course, much larger error bars. This is the mean value and the slope for our target. And then we had all these beautiful models, very well fit to the frequencies, and that's where they fall. So we have a problem. So we're really not doing well with the interiors, but we're somehow compensating in the outer part. By the way, that guy is the smallest chi-square. And the second smallest chi-square is that guy. So we're not even getting closer or anything like it. Okay? This is something that we really have to take care of. Sorry? This is around 1.15 or so, depending on the model. So we produce two models to match exactly the ratios, okay? And those have different masses. They have different compositions, and they have different ages, unsurprisingly, because we really don't have very good spectroscopic determinations. But I think not everything is lost. First of all, they both need overshooting, and that's a very good constraint. The convective core exists, and we need overshooting. They have almost the same central composition, And in terms of acoustic radius or total acoustic radius of the star, they both have the position of the convective core exactly in the same place. Since they don't have the same mass, I think that's the best way to compare them. So we really need to understand what these ratios are sensitive to and what are the genesis involved. I mean, we really have to study that parameter space. And by the way, the masses agree with the ones that we found with the direct method with one sigma. Just for the record, I mean, the data doesn't really allow. These are the D02s, and these two models that we find that fit the ratios perfectly, they have D02s which are different, and that could help us disentangle between them. But the current status of the data, I think, doesn't say much yet. So as a summary, the scaling relations, they are helpful to find evolutionary sequence. They provide mass and radius for field star. That's, I think, it's really, really amazing. They're model independent. And they can allow us to do differential aid determination. So I think it's a good start. But we still have the metallicity effect. And we know they're precise, but are they accurate at all? Am I OK? Yeah, Travis? Yeah. OK. And so the other thing that we need to try to do is put some anchor points along the sequences. So these sequences, so the frequency ratios, we know they're sensitive to the deep interior. And they probe the existence and extension of the chemically mixed regions. So with this, we can really aim at reducing the age uncertainties, but we really need to find the degeneracies. I mean, I haven't even spoken about helium abundances. But the interesting thing is that they largely get rid of the surface effect, and that's something that we have to think. What are we really putting inside of that surface correction? Is really only surface? I think it's not. And if any of you have any idea how to deal with this, I will be happy to hear. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Victor. Sylvie?
OK, very interesting. I was going to ask a question, and you have just said something which makes me say it a little differently. I was going to say you have spoken a lot about metallicity effects, but not at all about helium. And you just mentioned it. But I think helium is extremely important, because if you change helium, the original helium content, you have different masses, you have different tracks, you have different everything. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to look at the different helium contents before reaching a definitive conclusion.
So
this is very important.
Instead of saying metallicity, I should have said chemical composition. And I agree. Out of the, for instance, those two models that we made tailored to fit the ratios, one of them has a fairly large helium abundance. And another one that reaches very close has an even larger helium abundance. So for sure it plays a role.
And but helium, maybe the helium effect may be more important than the metallicity effect.
So to just a few comments, first of all, thank you very much for providing a case that doesn't fit, because that's when things start to get interesting. Then we can begin to learn what's wrong with our stellar models. Although the second comment, you have to be a bit careful about error bars. I mean, the one sigma error bar is pretty close. The two sigma, you expect to see two sigma deviations at a fairly high rates, given the statistics. I mean, of course, things are never Gaussian exactly, but we have to keep that in mind. The last comment is that you of course know that a very similar work is being carried out by Isa Brandao and Margarita Cunha in Porto, and it would be very interesting to compare.
Yeah, I mean,
in detail, her diagnostics
with
yours.
On this. They were in, and some of the models are coming from Isa actually.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
good.
Yeah.
Thank you. But this is very interesting, obviously.
So for each of those stars, now that you have a radius, you can predict a parallax. Can you speak to your error bars on that and how that'll be tested by Gaia?
So I don't know exactly. I mean, with Luca, we have tried a couple of, I mean, Luca spoke about that on Monday. So OK, we tried it the other way around, actually, for the ones we had parallaxes, and we estimated the angular diameters using infrared flux method and radius from the direct method. We check if the distances agreed, for instance. But I haven't done the estimate on the other way around, actually. I don't know if you have any idea on the error on that, Luca. But that's true.
Last question?
All
right.
On the matter of combining multiple spectroscopic measurements and other things, I think that you should, that really, it, people in this community really just absolutely should not just take a couple of independent measurements and just average them together in an error box.
No, that's what we did. We didn't consider any.
Yeah, okay, but my point is the spectroscopic constraint's a real one, just like the temperature constraint is. And spectroscopic abundances have known responses to changes in temperature. And so what I'd contend you absolutely have to do is you have to take these spectroscopic samples, calibrate them against a baseline. There's a known response to the metallicity against the zero point of the temperature, and have to go through the error propagation and basically separate out cleanly random and systematic errors. And the point is, if you do this, then you have, say, a real metallicity constraint with a real error that comes from spectroscopy, and you have to, but if you just take two different surveys that may have, you know, 200 degree offsets and 0.2 dex metallicity differences,
sure,
then you're really just measuring systematic and not random when you add those things.
For the same reason we decided, I mean, we, as a constraint, we did use the effective temperature, but coming from the infrared flux method. We didn't take anything from spectroscopy in this one. Precisely because of that. So the metallicity is completely free.
Okay. Well, I mean, the spectroscopic metallicity and the SED of the star are real observational constraints on a physical model, just like the frequencies are.
Well, I think we have to move on to the last speaker before the coffee break. If there are more questions, we can still ask them. Yeah, and we have to thank Victor again. So the next speaker is Masao Takata. And he will talk about degeneracy of the mode classification of adiabatic oscillations of stars.